Catherine Davis, coming up, Heart of Mind, Radio for the New Millennium.
Inside my skin, there is this space. It twists and turns, it bleeds and aches. Inside my heart, there's an empty room. It's waiting for lightning, it's waiting for you. And
of Fear, and coming up, Come to the River by Diane Reeves.
Yeah. I'll be waiting by the shore. Stand in a circle with love and arms around you, yeah. Come to the river where the mighty waters flow. And as the river unwinds, you'll see the turns of your life.
Welcome back. We are so happy to be here today. We have a wonderful program, and we are going to be talking about establishing our health freedom, freedom of health, medical freedom. How do we stand up for ourselves in the face of controversy? And joining me today to have this discussion is Martha Rowan. Martha Rowan is a wife, mother, and grandmother, a longtime resident of Brooklyn Heights and Bay Ridge, and a retired high school and college teacher. In her community, she has fought to protect libraries, free speech, and information access, and she has worked to make our streets and parks safer for all road users. She is the Medical Freedom Party's candidate for New York State Senate in the 26th District in Brooklyn, and she is to be an independent voice for freedom and for a healthy, safe environment for New Yorkers. And I want to welcome you, Martha, to WBAI. Hello.
Hello, and thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate this opportunity.
Oh, you're very, very welcome. And I know you are, as it seems, an activist. But you didn't come to this naturally, in the sense that representing this party. And I'm wondering if you can give us some idea of what motivated you to be part of this effort to fight for health freedom. Medical Freedom Alliance is the name of the organization.
Yep. Yes, the Medical Freedom Alliance is an organization that formed early in 2020 to sort of help us work out the coming together to work out what was going on with all of this, all the things that surrounded COVID, the initially the lockdowns, the mask mandates, the rules about how many people you could see, all of which seemed very extreme, ineffective, unnatural, and destructive of human contact. So we were determined that we would stay together and treat each other as human beings. So we met regularly and educated ourselves on the subject and decided that we, you know, and thought about different ways to deal with things. And we started out with rallies, and then we decided we needed to do more different kinds of things. And one of them was parent outreach with parents who were dealing with issues with their children in schools and with their children being, this was at the point where the schools were reopened and there were all kinds of rules and regulations for the children that were very emotionally and physically damaging to them. So parents needed needed information and support, and that was one of the groups that developed in from the Medical Freedom Alliance. But then some of us decided maybe we should look into politics. I think almost all of us who were doing this were like me, not anybody who had been involved in politics before, but that was something we spent some time educating ourselves about. Started looking into helping with other people's campaigns, but then on the day after, we decided that we might consider developing our own party. And on the day after Easter, we had a meeting and decided, yes, we would start a party, our own party, the Medical Freedom Party. And immediate, and then right after that, we started going out petitioning. And I initially was not going to be one of the people who, it never occurred to me to be a candidate. But then the new petitioning period opened up with this redistricting. And we really wanted to have a fair number of candidates. So I said, okay, this is such an important issue. I really need to do more. And I said I would run. And it's been a learning curve, I will say that. But we managed in 2 months to get 8 people on the November ballot, just going out with the petitions in hand, asking people to sign our petitions. And it was, as I said earlier, the petitioning for me was ultimately a very positive experience. It really improved my sense of my faith in my fellow human beings, I must say.
Well, that's really nice to hear. And I find I had begun to lose hope, but not so much in the fellow human beings in our systems. Yeah. So, but the sad thing is that one of the real bad outcrops of this whole panic, health panic, has been mainstream media and politicians who have in some ways allowed this to silo people into different camps. And then with what seems to me personally as an over-exaggeration of risks and under provision of real information caused people to really panic and caused people to begin to turn against each other in ways that in retrospect seems highly unnecessary, because a lot of what was put out there as the potential dangers turned out not to be based so much on facts.
Yes,
and so go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly what I experienced. And I think all of us have had experiences with our friends and within our own families. I've certainly had that within my own family. And it's extremely distressing and heartbreaking to have a situation where you can't even talk to one another about it. And I had kind of stopped, pretty much 100% stopped watching television or reading most of the mainstream media before any of this started. But my husband's a big TV watcher, and I would see what was going on the television, and it was constant. Every few minutes, there was some horrible, terrifying thing about COVID that was just designed to make people hysterically fearful. But then when I was looking into the actual facts, that level of fear was just simply not justified for most people who were basically healthy. This was not, you could get sick with it for sure, but the likelihood that you would get seriously ill and die was very small. It was only for a small number of people who were already very sick that this was a threat. But when people are panicky, it's only natural to lash out if you think that people are threatening your life or your health. And there was so much designed to make people feel that way, saying that you had to wear masks, which, by the way, all the evidence shows are absolutely useless and, in fact, are very harmful to people's health, the people who are wearing them, and even, for that matter, to people, the people around them. But that in itself says something about our fellow human beings, our biohazards. We have to be afraid of them. We have to stay away from them rather than hugging them and talking to them and recognizing that we're all in this together in the positive way, not the way that it was given to us early on. So that was one of the things that Medical Freedom Alliance, we would meet, and we still do meet every Sunday at 1:30 East 83rd Street, 122 East 83rd Street. All people are welcome to come.
Is that in Brooklyn or Manhattan?
No, it's in Manhattan. It's in Manhattan, just off Lexington Avenue. And it's a place where people can come together and talk about what they've experienced and share information that they have learned, share their experiences, share what is happening around them, and most importantly, talk about ways that we can resolve these problems. But one of the things that was our right very early on was that we were fellow human beings. We were not afraid of one another. We didn't hesitate to hug, to shake hands, to be together in groups larger than were being allowed at the time. And it was a very great bonding experience. But I found when I was petitioning that I was so surprised, I shouldn't say surprised exactly, but encouraged by how positive most people were about somebody like me or some of our other candidates that I helped to petition about our just coming out to be on the ballot. I mean, they were just very encouraging. They were willing to sign. And even people who disagreed with us would say, you know, I don't agree with you. I don't intend to vote for you, but I believe you have a right to be on the ballot. So I'm going to sign your petition. Mm-hmm. And then there were many others who were just so happy to hear that there were people out there because they felt isolated, alone, to discover that there were other people who felt the same way that they did and that there were actually people running for office.
Mm-hmm. I agree with most of what you're saying at this stage of the game, but I want to push back a little bit because you're running for office, and I wanted to speak on behalf of the class levels of difference from the vantage point of what you're speaking about. So when you speak about people who are feeling isolated and alone, has to refer to people who are in living environments in which they're isolated and alone. And I think one of the problems you might have seen in poorer neighborhoods is that people were not isolated and alone. People were living on top of each other, a lot of people in the same house, providing fertile ground for spreading of the virus, because the virus is real. People got it. People died. And in the same community where there's this overcrowding in the community, there's not sufficient health care for those communities. And so I think that in the grand scheme of things, there needs to be room for understanding health needs. in the context of medical freedom and medical rights, we need to understand that people do need to be taken care of. And I remember in the height of it, when I was deeply concerned and seeing it as a real health problem, that the idea that it was only people with health conditions was almost like an afterthought, where in my community, that's a large percentage of the population. And so those people, my family, like my eldest brother died from COVID-19. My middle brother got COVID-19 and survived. But so I'm just saying that it being a real issue, and even though at this stage it's kind of gone, as things arise, I want to ensure that vulnerable people will be taken care of and not, in a manner of speaking, forgotten. And the other side of that coin is not just the politics of it, but I don't think the medical institutions were willing to give treatments to people pre-vaccine. So my eldest brother got COVID before the vaccine came out, and he was essentially just sent home from the hospital to die. And there were many treatments at that time, while they may not have been perfect, could very easily have preserved his life. And those were not available to people because the politic of the day was to demonize certain drugs because a certain president might have mentioned it, or demonizing certain drugs like ivermectin, saying it was a horse medicine when it was really a Pulitzer Prize winning drug for human beings. And other things, steroids, there were all of these things that the revolutionary, the really true doctors were talking about that were suppressed. And a lot of people died for that reason. And the other thing I wanted to bring out is the problem in the very, very beginning with when they had the the intubation machines. And they didn't use them in the right calibrations, and a lot of people died simply as a result of that, which was an error. You know, you can't demonize people for that. However, what was also happening at that same time is that people in poor communities were sent home. They were told that they couldn't come into the hospital till they were in an emergency. So they went home. They spread the virus and only would get into the hospital in an emergency situation and then would be finished off by those machines. And this was during the time when you saw all these vans outside of hospitals full of people who had passed. And so it was a very complex series of events that led to that. And I think that's part of the dynamic of the argument, is that there are people who really do need to be taken care of, and we can't be flippant about that, even though even with my experience, I advocate for what you're talking about in medical freedom. So that's a lot to lay on you.
Yes, I completely agree. And one of the things that distressed me terribly at the beginning was the two-tiered kind of attitude about all of these, I shouldn't say two-tiered, but the cavalier attitude of so many people who were in a comfortable situation about these lockdowns and the effect that they were having on people. The people who suffered from the lockdowns were the people who couldn't just stay home in a comfortable setting and go to work by means of their laptops, and their kids have plenty of room to play around when they weren't able to go to school, and good access to the internet in order to have some level of education. And yes, I absolutely agree. As a matter of fact, I have a friend whose brother was in a similar situation to yours, to your family members. He was feeling sick. He went to an emergency room. They initially told him to just go home, and wait until he was sicker. And then when he felt sicker, he went back again, and they put him on this the ventilator with the treatments, and he died. And she feels very strongly that this was he died because of he was not properly treated. And the suppression and censorship over the treatments that were available, such as hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin, and there are many others as well, that as simple as things like making sure people keep their vitamin D levels up. And in New York City, there's so many people for whom this is their vitamin D levels are very low. And all of the studies show that vitamin D, that having adequate vitamin D levels is one of the things that people with adequate vitamin D levels are much more likely to survive and do well, even if they are infected. And it's disgraceful. It's disgraceful that we could have something that calls itself a public health system that does not tell people about these simple health things like making sure you have a good diet and that you're getting adequate vegetables or whatever, and that your vitamin D levels are up. Vitamin D is not hugely expensive. It's easy enough for doctors to test, and you can bring them up very quickly with supplements. And yet you don't see anything about that on, say, for example, the New York City health departments. They're just telling you, get vaccinated, get vaccinated, get vaccinated. And they're pushing this vaccine on babies as young as 6 months old. And they're telling parents things that simply aren't true. And,
exactly.
This is very distressing. We sent a letter, which I was the major person to draft it, to the commissioner of the New York City Health Department, informing them of the ways in which the advice that they were giving to parents was absolutely not true, and was giving parents, pushing them with fear into thinking that if they didn't get their very young children vaccinated, that they were going to get very seriously ill and die, when it's simply not true. And that letter is available. It's an open letter, and I encourage others to read it and send it themselves to let the health department. They're still sending out these things. It's on my website, MarthaForStateSenate.com. That's Martha for F-O-R. It's written out, MarthaForStateSenate.com. And it's under, if you go to the top, you'll see it says letter to the health department. So yes, this, and one of the positions that I have is that, first of all, the censorship, people have to have the right, and this is part of the Nuremberg Code, it's been incorporated into U.S. law and into the New York State law, is that people must have informed decision, be able to make an informed consent. You can't just say to make people take things, you can't force them to take a medication, especially when, as these are, still all of these, the vaccines that are available are experimental. The earliest point at which the experiments will end is sometime next year, and some of them don't end until I think 2024, 2025. These are experimental vaccines. They have been from the beginning. And to mandate them, force people to take them, unless if they don't take them, they'll lose their jobs or can't go to school, and to intimidate them, to terrify them, to give them a misinformation, to get them to get them to take it, and to censor information from world-renowned doctors and scientists because it might cause, quote-unquote, vaccine hesitancy. Well, I will tell you, for many people, hesitancy is the very least that is appropriate. It's coming out more and more that these vaccines are extremely dangerous for many, many people, for, I would say, for everybody, but certainly for a large number of people. They're real serious risks. Young men and young boys especially for getting, and this is hardly limited to them, but they have a particularly high risk of myocarditis and pericarditis, which is an extremely serious condition.
And these are heart conditions.
Yes. Yeah, and one of the things that upset me so much was to hear on the news people saying, and people from the CDC saying things like, oh, these are mild conditions. Heart specialists, a cardiologist such as Dr. Peter McCullough, has said there is absolutely no such thing as a mild case of myocarditis or pericarditis, because these conditions leave scar tissue in the heart, and this can have terrible effects later on. Mm-hmm. So, and that's just one of the things that we know that these vaccines cause. So, in order for people to be able to make an informed decision, they have to have access to information. But if information is being censored and a certain agenda and narrative is being pushed endlessly through the media, and when doctors, another thing is that doctors are being intimidated into not being allowed to tell their patients. I know my husband was asking his doctor what she thought, and she was being very careful in her response. I sort of felt that it was kind of maybe coming through that she was suggesting he might be hesitant to, he might consider not doing this, but she couldn't say it. And many doctors I just feel terrified to say anything because they will be, they have fear of losing their licenses or losing their jobs.
I know it's a serious problem, because information is what can save people's lives, and we can use to save our own lives. First of all, to understand what the real risk factors are, like you were speaking about vitamin D, and having the correct levels of zinc to help uplift the immune system. There are things that we can do on an ongoing basis to really have an impact on our susceptibility, and this is important because this whole experience is a learning experience, and I don't believe this is going to be the last trip down this road. There's going to be more and more and more, and there's a lot of politics around that I'm not going to bring in, something like, all this studying of viruses in labs all over the world, so there's a lot of problems, and I think that there really is a place for an organizations, for parties that are going to put this at the forefront of their considerations, because the medical rights issue is intermingled, interdependent on so many social issues that people have to deal with, that I really think it's important that what you're bringing forth, what your group is bringing forth, we really need that perspective, and it's been denied. And I believe that many, many people have died from the lack of information more than anything else, and from the lack of access to appropriate and timely health care is a big part of why the numbers were so high. And not being willing to look at and collate the research, the results, not being willing to say, well, why is it that in these developed countries there are millions of deaths, and in the underdeveloped countries there's not? You know, everybody was said, oh, we're so scared for Africa. But as it turns out, their lifestyle protected them for much, much greater than our lifestyles in the West protected us. And we need to collate this information so that we could understand. I was looking at an interview of a doctor who supports a health group in Uganda, I think it is. And the doctor was saying that in the countryside, people were not getting COVID-19. They were out in the fields doing their work. Well, yeah, they had sunshine, which means they had vitamin D. They had oxygen. You know, so even had they been exposed, they would probably have had a better go of it.
Oh, yes, absolutely. One of the terrible things about the policies that they instituted at the beginning was to push people inside. As you mentioned, people who live out in the suburbs with big houses, that's not necessarily in a backyard. That's not necessarily a huge issue. But for those of us who live in New York City with small apartments and families stuck together in an apartment with maybe one bedroom, and they're not getting fresh air, they're not getting sunshine, they're not getting exercise, they're the emotions and stress, and we know that stress and emotions depress the immune system. All of this is just designed to make people sick. And I remember early on when they were first starting to talk about rolling out the vaccines, there were a number of countries in Africa where the president said, no, we don't want this. We don't need this. And I remember, I can't remember what country it was, but one of them was saying, we have herbal remedies. We have herbal remedies that work very well to treat this. You know, I think a lot of people just say, oh, herbal remedies, but these are
even worse. At least three of those presidents had assassination attempts against them.
Oh, they were assassinated.
Yeah.
They were in fact, I think it begins with an M. One of the countries where the president did a test where he used the PCR test on testing papaya.
Oh, yeah, I remember that, yeah.
And all kinds of other motor oil and all kinds of other things, and sent them into the labs, and they came back positive. He was a chemist. He was a very highly educated scientist himself. He ended up dying under very suspicious circumstances. We are dealing with one of the reasons why I felt it was essential that we get out here and run in this political arena, which I am the first to admit is stacked and I will go so far as to say quite corrupt, is that we need to have voices speaking out against what's happening, because what we're facing in New York is something that I really don't hesitate to call totalitarianism. Whether it's incipient or already well advanced is something we can debate. But we have all kinds of a governor who continually renews states of emergency, which gives her untold amounts of power to do things that constitutionally are simply beyond the pale. Now, I understand that Governor Hochul has now ended or will not renew the state of emergency on COVID, which is good news for as long as it lasts. But she has a number of other states of emergency out there. She's declared a state of emergency on monkeypox, and I think on polio, and I think And there are a number of others, maybe some states of disaster. This is a way for the state to bring in a lot of federal money, but it is also a way to give her powers that, that nobody who initially designed the Constitution, I think that most voters do not want to have one person have. That's why we have separation of powers. That's why we have elections, so that we have, and we have separation of powers so that it is the legislative bodies that make laws, that decide what can say what people can and cannot do. The legislative bodies are answerable to voters. They have to be reelected every 2 years. They have to go out and speak to their constituents. That's why it's that those powers are put in their hands and not in the hands of one person who is, in the case of both Cuomo and Hochul, were trying to make themselves into monarchs. New York State is not a monarchy.
Yeah, I'm listening to the siren in the background, and I'm thinking, we're in a state of emergency. So it's kind of to bring us all to an alert. You know, the thing is, though, I think that what these governors and mayors and senators and, you know, Congress people are doing, not just the state level, but the national level, is that the whole system has been compromised and co-opted, as we all know, by moneyed interests. And they're not really acting on behalf of the citizenry. And and I say this because it's more than just the individual person that is trying to be a dictator. The system is set up to put these little hunters into place state by state, so that people can be controlled. So it's a much bigger problem. And granted, I think it's important that we work from the ground up. We do need to get people into office to be able to advocate for us. But we also have to recognize how powerful the system itself is. Because in the last couple of years, I voted for a lot of so-called progressives that once they got into office, they turned coat and went down the party line. And I found that to be very, very disappointing. But I think it's because the pressure is so great, because it's all about the money. It's, you know, show me the money. The pharmaceutical industries, among others, pour so much money into our governmental structures, into politicians, that they only act in the best interest of those companies. And I think, or those industries, which are multinational, they have allegiance to no one. So I've slipped into ranting and raving, but I just think that I hope that people will really look at these issues, step outside of the fear, step outside of the condemnation of what the other person thinks, and begin to realize that we're all being boiled together slowly in this stew if we don't take back our control over our lives, over our health systems, and over the politics.
Yes, I completely agree. The powerful money interests, and certainly when it comes to all of these healthcare decisions, the pharmaceutical industry, and also the amount of money coming from the pharmaceutical industry, but also from actors like Bill Gates and his organizations. They have enormous amounts of money into, well, if we talk about the media and the censorship on the media, I can't remember what exactly the percentage is, but it's something close to 3/4 of their income comes from the pharmaceutical income and from, and then there were also money given by Bill Gates to these organizations and also the federal government. And it's only natural. It's just part of the way economics works that if the people who are funding you have an interest or something that they want, and they either directly tell you or make it clear subtly that if you give out certain information or do certain things, or in the case of politicians, or support or institute policies that they don't like, all that money is going to dry up. Not only will it dry up, but it may be used against you with political opponents or with rivals in your business. So yes, and I think part of what we have to do is find a way to rein this in. And some of it, of course, is on levels that can't be done on the state level, but there's certain things that can be, and certain policies. For example, I would say that we should not allow a state of emergency to last more than 30 days. And once it's over, it cannot be renewed. That should give 30 days should give the governor and the legislature and the people who are dealing with whatever the issue is enough time to develop policies and strategies to deal with it, and then let the people and the structure of government, which hopefully we can make less less corrupt, can deal with it. I have much more faith in the people of New York and the people and people to actually deal with these problems. We also need to pull back on all of these things that are called partnerships, public-private partnerships, or I would say private-public partnerships. They sound good. Oh, it's nice that all these big corporations are going to be contributing money to help the government do things. But that's what fascism is called. That's when you have the government and these big corporations, which, as you say, are multinational. They have no allegiance to our country, to our state, to our people. They live on a different level, in their own little world that is above everything else. And there's no, they don't care about any particular country. And we do, because we live here. Exactly. And so we need to cut back on this idea. One of the problems with the CDC is that I think it's 40% of their income. I'm sorry, the FDA, for over 40% of their income comes from the pharmaceutical companies. And I think there are other ways in which they also, aside from the direct payments from the pharmaceutical companies, they also are able to have, and I think this is true, certainly of the CDC, I think it may also be true of the FDA, to have investments in these drugs and vaccines. How can their interest not be influenced by that? It's just not possible.
It's insane.
And we have to stop allowing this.
Excellent. We have a few minutes for phone calls. We're speaking with Martha Rowan, and she is the Medical Freedom Party's candidate for New York State Senate in the 26th District in Brooklyn. I'm going to take a few phone calls, and while I'm doing that, Martha, would you go over your platform and let people know what the points are?
Okay. My platform is basically... one thing that I would say about my overall philosophy for platform is that I want my platform to grow out of what my constituents need. And that means I need, as a senator, to be on the ground with the people, to talk to them, get them together, be available to discuss with them in your particular community, what is the thing that you find the most serious problem? And what do you think are the solutions? Because who are the best people to come up with the solutions for problems? Not people in think tanks, not lobbyists for big corporations. It's the people themselves who are living with it, who know what's possible and who know how to solve the problems.
We're going to take some calls before we run out of time. Hello, you're on the air. Speak
hi.
Up. Yes.
Yes, hi. I just want to thank you so much for your courage in saying words that need to be said for so long. I'm glad that, you know, this show does not have the classic censorship, because this is literally a breath of fresh air. And you're, you know, voicing the opinion of so many people. And I really, really appreciate the service.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Okay, we're going to go to our next caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, Kathy. It's Russell. I'd like to ask Martha, you know, I've noticed a few articles that talk about these mRNA vaccines have been experimented with since the 90s as a cancer cure or a preventive. Has Martha noticed any of that? Because it seems to me that his Biden's cancer moonshot sort of coincided with this population-wide experiment on us with these mRNA vaccines. Thank you very much, Martha.
Thank you.
Yes, I understand that that when the mRNA technology was first developed, the first thing they thought of was that it would be very good for targeting cancer. And that's what they tried to use it for. And as I understand it, it was an absolute abysmal failure. So when I heard that Biden was talking about this moonshot of an mRNA cure for cancer, I was kind of nonplussed. I don't know whether he just doesn't know what's happening, or I can't even imagine what they're thinking. Yes, this is a technology that has failed on every level. It failed. And I have to admit, the other thing that he talked about writing like software into people's cells. What are we, cyborgs? This is very disturbing, frankly. I find it extremely disturbing.
Yes. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning. As usual, you always have, Kathy, a great program. Thank you. God bless you.
Thank you.
I just wanted to say you speak for me, and I'm so happy to hear, because we've been bombarded so much. You know, if you don't do this, you're a bad person. You don't have access to work, which is what happened to me. I lost my job. I mean, and you're so right. This feels, I'm more scared of what's going on than these images that they bombard us all the time with. You know, the totalitarianism, it sure feels like that. If I can't feed my family, you know, we're in danger. And this overuse, exactly, of emergency, yeah. What about treatments? That's supposed to be first before they do vaccines. There's so much wrong with this. And I thank you for speaking out. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. All right, so I'm not pre-screening. We're just taking random calls. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, Kathy.
Yes.
How are you?
Good, thank you.
Good. I just want to thank the guest who's on and say what you're speaking is absolute truth to power, and it's absolutely beautiful to hear that on WVAI. Gary Noll, Kathy, Dr. Kakai, and maybe a few other people are doing the best hard-hitting investigative work on WBAI, and you being on the air speaking about this party is exactly in alignment of what WBAI represents. And I just want to tell you, my renewed faith in the station after listening to today's program is just gone skyrocketed. I just want to say thank you. And it's amazing to hear how a party has come together like this. I'm on Long Island, but I'll come to New York and campaign and volunteer for you.
Excellent. Thank you so much for that call. And we're just about out of time, though the board is full of calls. I might have to bring you back just to be able to talk to people. And we've been speaking with Martha Rowan, and she is the Medical Freedom Party's candidate for New York State Senate in the 26th District in Brooklyn. Can you tell us how people can get in touch with you as well as the Medical Freedom Party?
Sure. My website is marthaforstatesenate.com, and that's for written out F-O-R, marthaforstatesenate.com. Also, the Medical Freedom Party's website is medicalfreedomparty.com, and the Medical Freedom Alliance is mfany.org. mfany.org. You can also reach me by email. My email is martharowan@gmail.com. I welcome any questions or comments. I need feedback from people in order to run a campaign that really responds to what people need.
All right. So thank you so much for joining me today. We have to move along with the program, but I'm so, so happy that we were able to put this together. Martha Rowan, and she is a wife, mother, grandmother, and longtime resident of Brooklyn Heights and Bay Ridge, a retired high school and college teacher in her community. She fought to protect libraries, free speech, and information access, and has worked to make our streets and parks safer for all road users. And now here she is again taking on the voice of the people. So let's all appreciate that. Thank you again, Martha.
Oh, and thank you so much for giving me this opportunity to speak.
Bye-bye for now.